Welcome to Fireside Markets, your audio home for thoughtful and insightful discussions of financial markets, investment strategies, economics, retirement, and more. Fireside Markets is hosted by James Osborne, president of Basin Asset Management, a Colorado registered investment advisor.
Hello, this is James Osborne, and you're listening to Fireside Markets, a project of Basin Asset Management. Thanks for joining us. Today's guest is Mebben Faber. Meb is co-founder and chief investment officer of Cambria Investments. He is a blogger at mebfaber.com and the brains behind the Idea Farm. Meb is also the author of several books, including his latest book, Global Asset Allocation, which he's here to talk to us about today. Meb, welcome to Fireside Markets.
Great to be here.
So as some background, tell us a little bit about how you got into the investment world and talk about who Cambria is.
Like many, somewhat a winding path, somewhat atypical. And, you know, my background in undergrad and some grad school was biotech and engineering, but had always had a pretty strong passion for markets. And my first job after college, I was going to take a year off before going back and finishing grad school, was as a biotech equity analyst. And, you know, this is in 2000, one of the most exciting times for both investing as well as biotech, you know, the race to sequence the genome. I was working outside of DC, so would go to all the NIH offices and the drug approval FDA meetings, as well as sitting in and chatting with companies. And of course, the markets were well onto the biggest bubble we've seen in the US and then subsequent crash. And in my spare time, I was taking grad school at Hopkins. But after that year, I said, you know, this is just too exciting. I'm going to take another year before I go back for a PhD and you know, fast forward 7 years or 10 years, whatever it was. You know, that PhD still hasn't happened, but the good news is moved out west and was up in the San Fran, Tahoe before moving to LA to start Cambria back in 2006 and was, you know, at that time unsure what sort of money management company this was going to be when we grew up, but always had a quant focus and beginnings. And yeah, fast forward, but 7 years now, and, it's grown to be my career, and biotech is now my hobby.
Just out of curiosity, what was the PhD? Was it still in the biotech area?
Yeah, my focus was always on genetics and gene therapy side, and I loved it and still do. And you know, there's always a part of you that when you hit the fork in the road and went one way,
sure,
you know, has a little longing for that area, you know. And it's interesting because you're finally starting to see a lot of the developments in the biotech space come to fruition over the past few years, and it's just incredible to watch. But it's still fun as a hobby, you know. You look at the biotech index and it's up something like double digit returns last 4 or 5 years in a row. In many of those years, north of 20-40%. You know, it seems to happen a nice boom and bust in biotech about every 4 or 6 years, but
right.
It's probably long in the tooth now, but it's a pleasant distraction at this point. And, you know, I'm more of a quant macro guy these days.
So how did Cambria come to be about? What was the driving force?
So my partner, Eric Richardson, has a legal kind of VC law background, corporate law, and I had always been on the research side. And so it was a good complement. And he was looking to start an investment advisor. I wasn't quite sure that, you know, I turned down a job at a big $15 billion firm to move to the beach. My father was furious, thought it was a moron. But I said, look, you know, worst case scenario, I live in Los Angeles for a year. I've always been a mountain guy, but I said I'll trade my skis for a surfboard. Worst case, I live at the beach for a year and can always go back into a more traditional investing job. But, you know, it started out slow, like many startups and entrepreneurship. I'm sure can resonate with you as a you know, proprietor, but it's grown over time. And you know, we started out doing individual accounts and hedge funds, but then really realized a lot of the research in money management we're doing, our biggest audience was actually other advisors in some institutions, and so public funds made a lot more sense, and that's kind of the direction we've gone in the last 2 years.
And the shop is largely, can I safely call you quantitative value managers?
Yeah, it's quant light. I mean, it's nothing that's like a lot of the super deep algorithmic complex type of quants. You know, we're more of the let's think about what works from a 10,000 foot view. So value on one hand, but also momentum and trend on the other. And, you know, we fully believe that both strategies work and work well over time and don't always work at the same time and don't always work, but fully appreciate both sides of the coin. So my emotional makeup is actually much more aligned with the latter, the trend side of the world. But because I fully appreciate that value works as well, putting in objective quantitative rules that lets me bias certain portfolios or approaches towards value works, even though it's emotionally much more difficult for me. But I believe in both sides.
Yeah, we're going to come back to that, the gap, if you will, between value and momentum, because I think it's, one, it's fascinating, and I think they may very well be, you know, opposite sides of the coin, as you said. So we're going to come back to that. But I want to talk briefly about the new book. So you've written a handful of books now. Most people are, if they're familiar with you, are familiar with the Ivy Portfolio book, and then Shareholder Yield, of course, and Global Value, which I think maybe came out last year or the year before. The new book, Global Asset Allocation, talk to me about why there was a need for another book.
So this is our fourth book, and it, you know, calling it a book is a stretch. It's about 100 pages, but that's intentional. You know, along with the last two books, I spend inordinate amount of time editing it down so that you can read it in one sitting.
It is very readable. So
there's nothing worse than getting a 400-page finance book that should be 10 pages or 50 pages, right?
It's
So we try to make it short and simple, and it could have been much longer, but that's not really the goal. So the reason we wrote it is that there's a lot of people out there. It's not necessarily every day, but it's certainly every week. My friend and family come up to me and say, Meb, you do this for a living. I have a 401k, or here's my retirement money, or here's my college savings fund for my children. What do I do with it? How do I invest my money? And that's a simple question, but a not necessarily simple answer. And I used to hem and haw and say, well, we can sit down and talk about your goals, and it depends, and what do you foresee your risk tolerances are, all this stuff. But I would usually say, okay, here's three or four funds. You could go buy these Vanguard funds or index funds and just hold them, and then, you know, rebalance every once in a while, and would then talk to these individuals a month or 6 months later and come back to the topic, say, well, did you go buy those funds I emailed you? They say, well, no, I got busy, or I'm just going to go with whatever, you know, my advisor telling me, or whatever's sitting in this account. And so realized that there was a pretty strong need for people to understand at a very basic level the asset allocation process, what it looks like, but most importantly, to look back over the last 40 years, which is a lot of different markets, up markets, down markets, bear markets, good growth, bad growth, inflation, disinflation, maybe deflation, everything across the board. And so I'd say, how have the 15 or so most popular asset allocation models performed over the last 40 years? Because there's a lot of gurus out there saying, hey, I think you should invest in X or Y. And many people spend most of their day or time when they're thinking about asset allocation and wringing their hands. Is it time to sell stocks? How much should I put in gold? Is it the US dollar going up? What should I do? And they spend a ton of time stressing about it. And so we wanted to look and say, hey, look, here's how these have all done. And, you know, we can get into this more about the performance and how it goes, but we just wanted to show to people, hey, this is what you can expect. This is what things have looked like historically, to give them a little more information. And also, we think there's takeaways of how the best possible way to be allocating, because there's a lot of very basic mistakes people make that end up putting them in serious jeopardy as far as their long-term goals.
So what are those?
Okay, so one of the biggest takeaways is that there's a finite number of what we call asset classes, right? There's stocks globally, there's bonds, there's real assets like commodities or real estate, and all of those assets have a time and a place, you know, where they do well, where they do poorly or very poorly. In general, the different types of asset classes are better and worse in different environments. Bonds will do better when we face falling interest rates or a deflationary environment. Stocks typically do well in a growth sort of environment. But we looked at all these portfolios and said, and they're vastly different. You know, some have 25% in gold, some have zero. Some have, 60% in bonds, some have 10. And so the biggest takeaway is that as long as you have some of each category, some stocks, some bonds, some real assets, your performance over time is pretty similar, right? They may zig and zag over different years, and some portfolios do better in some regimes. So in the 70s, if you had more real assets because it was an inflationary environment, you typically did better. And there's some portfolios that have been more consistent, but in general, they mostly end up in the same place. And I think if you compared all of the portfolios, the spread between the best and the worst was under 2 percentage points a year. And to me, that's somewhat of an astonishing takeaway, because a lot of the things that people do and a lot of time they spend, if you were to say, hey, look, you know, the difference between all these portfolios was, and I'm picking a number out of a hat, somewhere between 10 and 8% a year, they'd say, oh, well, why am I spending so much time stressing about this? What I should be spending time, and you're thinking about buy and hold, is, you know, how much am I paying for these funds? How tax efficient are they? Where am I holding them? And really importantly, am I doing anything dumb that would jeopardize their return? So typically it's buying when markets are very bubbly and or selling after they've crashed, which is the emotionally challenging thing that people do, which is natural, right? But they typically are their own worst enemy. So people, the conclusion of the book is typically think people are focusing on the wrong thing, right? They spend way too much time with their asset allocation when they should be focusing on how much am I paying for this and am I leaving it alone? Am I mucking around with it and causing it to do a much worse job than it would normally?
Yeah, I mean, we in the industry love to debate asset allocation, to argue over small value tilt and whether that has value or has in the past or will in the future. We argue over, you know, ridiculously small splits to a palladium fund. And like you, my big takeaway from the book, and you've mentioned this in the past, and I've written about this a little bit as well, is it really doesn't matter very much. Number one, because the past performance, the gap is really not that big. And number two, we have no assurances that the best performing portfolio over the last 40 years is going to be the best performing portfolio over the next 40 years. I mean, if it were that simple, then everyone would own, I think it was Ellerain's portfolio in the book that has the highest, you know, nominal long-term return. And that you get no assurances about that.
Right. So, I mean, if you look at a very simple example now is, you know, interest rates have gone from double digits to 2% on the 10-year yield. You know, will that continue? Who knows? But that has been a very strong tailwind for bonds, for example. You know, and there's various periods where equities have just been gangbusters, you know, the 80s and 90s. And there's other periods where they weren't. And there's periods, if you look at the last 5 years, for example, foreign has drastically underperformed U.S.-based stocks, right? But that's waxes and wanes. And so we talk about a few things in the books that are some dumb things that people do. And probably in order, they are paying too much in fees, not allocating enough to foreign, right? So foreign as a percentage of market cap is at least 50% for equities and actually more for bonds. But most people in the U.S. allocate 70% to U.S. stocks, you know, it's a home country bias.
Yep.
Which is particularly challenging right now because the U.S. is one of the most expensive stock markets in the world. And then probably third would be they don't allocate enough to real assets. So commodities, including gold, real estate, tips are in that category. Most people have very little in that category because it's been 30 years since there was an inflationary environment of the 70s, and most of the people have kind of forgotten that. You know, the gold had a nice run and brought people back in, but, you know, commodities haven't, it's certainly many of them in the last 6 months have a reason why people don't want to allocate. But the those three things in the main, and then the fourth, which we label kind of smart beta and tactical, which we spend a lot of time doing at Cambria, we think is important and can add significant returns over time. But of the list of things that are important, it may not be the most for people that are buying and holding and holding for a long period. So it's kind of going back to what you mentioned. It's sexy and fun to talk about asset allocation because you can pull up highlighted flashing numbers on a screen every day and calculate your net worth to the second. But it's unfortunately probably not going to be the biggest determinant of your performance over time.
Sure. I mean, there's a whole sub industry that has sprung up to provide asset allocation advice, optimization, both to retail investors and to advisors. And, you know, you plug in your inputs of either past or expected returns and past or expected volatility and correlation, and you get a nice little, you know, optimized, quote unquote, portfolio from this. But the first step is that that's pretty worthless being based entirely on historical time periods and is very sensitive to the time period that you input. And the second piece is you get no assurances about what comes next. Go ahead.
And I agree with you that, you know, history is good as a guide, right? And I'd actually say often that people don't spend enough time with history to understand what's possible, right? So U.S. stocks, if you tell people, hey, look, you know, they've declined 80% before. There's a lot of people in the U.S. that kind of thumb their nose up at looking at what's happening in Greece or Russia or Europe in general and, you know, kind of commentary on, wow, look how terrible these markets are. Well, you know, the U.S. has declined by 80% too, and as have most asset classes. You know, you look commodities and REITs in 2008, 2009, declined around 70%. And so any one asset class has its good moments, and you should be prepared to lose at least 50% in almost any of them. Bonds, for example, have lost 50% in real terms, so including inflation. Most people don't understand that. So it's really tough to become asset class agnostic, you know, just like talking politics or religion. You know, people say, hey, look, you know, I'm a Democrat, or I'm a Muslim or a Hindu or a Christian, whatever it may be, and are very just fixed in their beliefs. But it's the same thing with investing. Most people are like, you know what, I'm a Buffett guy, I'm a value guy through and through, or I'm a stock guy, or I'm a gold bug. But every single one of those people, you know, or styles, I should say, has their moment in the sun, and also, you know, the time when they've get taken out to the woodshed. So it's when you're building a portfolio, you want it to be resilient in any market environment, the combination of the assets, and that's really what's most important, is it's the cumulative sort of behavior and characteristics.
Sure. And the irony is that the need for asset class diversification is also, in a sense, what makes it difficult at times to be a diversified investor. You know, one of the things that caught my eye in the book is, you know, you have this regularly recurring chart of the historical returns, or the growth of a dollar, if you will, type of chart for each one of these diversified portfolios that we look at. And almost all of them, with the exception of Buffett's, you know, 90-10 S&P 500 portfolio, almost all of them dramatically underperformed the U.S. stock market in the mid to late 90s for obvious reasons. But for some people, that creates a difficult environment. And that's not too different than what happened in 2014 as well, where it sort of felt like that late 90s environment of, why are we diversified? We could just own U.S. stocks. Look how well we would have done last year. And so my question is, you know, if diversification carries its own behavioral issues, is there a better strategy, or I should say, is there an asset allocation portfolio that can mitigate some of that behavioral risk?
You know, I say is, I mean, again, it kind of goes back to, I think the analogy we use in the book is baking, which I was told is not actually a great analogy because baking is sensitive. But I was talking about cookies. I said, look, as long as you have enough flour, sugar, butter, chocolate chips, you know, my grandmother would cook kind of just by feel, right? Like, it didn't matter the exact amount. They would usually come out tasting delicious. But if you totally excluded butter or flour or sugar, you know, your cookies are probably not going to be that great, or it's going to be a mess at certain times or whatever. And, you know, the same things with asset allocation. If you just invest in, say, stocks and bonds, you know, every G7 country's the 60-40 portfolio has lost, I think, close to two-thirds in that at some point over time in that portfolio. So most people don't see that as a safe portfolio, but it's really not. So, you know, having a little bit of each, real assets, stocks and bonds, and being diversified internationally, I think is most important. You know, there's a step I go further. So I add the tilts for value and momentum within equities, and then am a momentum guy as well. So, you know, have a momentum and trend or tactical approach, because my emotional makeup, it's very difficult for me to watch an asset or an investment decline and not do anything.
Right.
You know, whether it outperforms over time or not, and historically momentum and trend has, but to watch something, say like a stock or a S&P 500 theoretically go down 80% and not do anything emotionally is very challenging for me. You know, and the same thing, a great example recently is oil, you know, if you're an energy right. investor. But it has its own emotional challenges too, which is the whipsaws, where if you're a trend follower and you get these false breakouts or breakdowns and you have losing trades, and oil is a great example, probably had 3 or 4 years of just choppy markets and losing trades. That's trying in a different way, where it just kind of, you said, man, this trend approach is terrible, it doesn't work. And then all of a sudden, you know, oil goes from 100 to 110 to 40 or whatever the number was, then it makes up for all of the last 4 years combined. So it's a different philosophy, but I think this trend following momentum area is a wonderful complement to a buy and hold portfolio. It's a little more esoteric in how you implement it, but personally and emotionally, I think it's a good complement and to have a tactical piece to a buy and hold portfolio as well.
Yeah, and you bring up an interesting point, which is that maybe MEB would be a pretty terrible, you know, Graham Doddsville, Warren Buffett-esque value investor, just because you can't stomach it. And at the same time, I would probably be a pretty terrible momentum investor, because getting ripped and whipsawed would probably cause me to throw in the towel. And I think the big takeaway here is that there really is no cure-all. There is no perfect strategy. There is nothing that you can do as an investor that you're going to like all the time. There is no allocation or trading strategy or, you know, valuation metric that is going to work every time. And you don't have to be an investor for very long to see that happen. I mean, you just illustrated, you know, 08, 09, it makes it really difficult to be a long-term diversified buy and hold investor. You know, the last 3 or 4 years have made it pretty difficult to be a momentum trend following guy, because depending on the asset classes that you're using there, maybe the activity hasn't been right for that strategy in that market environment. And then, you know, if you're a deep value macro guy, you only needed 2014 to learn that doesn't always pay off in the short run. You know, if you bought the cheapest stocks in the world last year, congratulations, now you own a portfolio of even cheaper stocks.
And that, we'll get back to that in a second, but the it's important for investors to know a few things. One is to have reasonable expectations, and the best way to do that is become a student of history and say, hey, look, historically, real returns net of inflation, stocks globally have done about 5% a year, bonds about 2%, and T-bills about 1%. And that's on the high side. It's maybe a little less. But in general, that's a good rule of thumb.
Yep.
And many people expect much higher numbers. But I also realize the behavioral biases you have. So, for example, I have most of them. I'm overconfident. I'll take more risk when you give it to me. And I've learned these lessons as, thankfully, as a younger investor with much, less capital and having blown up once or twice, realized, hey, look, I need rules and parameters around how much risk I take, what sort of portfolios I build so that I can not be my own worst enemy. And so, for example, for the value side, we built a fund that, like you mentioned, invests in the 11 cheapest countries in the world. I would have loved to have waited and not launched it until the end of last year, because that, like you said, that fund got pummeled, that strategy got pummeled last year. But it, it only works in about, any given 60% of years. Right. But historically, it's a great strategy. But you have to be able to say emotionally, if you're doing this on your own, which is why, we launched the fund so that, come rebounds time, do you feel good buying Greece and Russia after they went down 40% and selling your U.S. stocks or whatever it may be? That's really difficult for most people, which is also one of the reasons why it works over time.
Exactly.
But understanding, one, your own emotional makeup, and two, having reasonable expectations. Most people bias their expectations on their own personal experience. Taleb would call that fooled by randomness. And so my mom grew up during the best, or not grew up, but her, most of her investing career was during the best bull market of anyone's lifetime. And her advice was always, yeah, you just buy stocks and you put them away. Well, of course that's what happened, because you're investing mostly during the 80s and 90s. Now, if you ask a millennial or someone young, hey, what do you do? And they say, what do you mean? I don't invest in stocks. That's a rigged game. You know, look at Enron, look at the last 50% bear markets. Now, this is changing in the last year or two after bull market year 6 and 7. But historically, you talk to a Japanese investor and they're like, what are you talking about? Stocks, like that's been dead money for 30 years. Why? And again, the last 2 years are an exception, but these sort of environments, someone who grew up in the Depression is going to have a very different perspective. So understanding history, what can happen, as well as your own emotional makeup, I think is really important.
Yeah. So something we touched on earlier that I want to get back to a little bit is home bias. You talk about this in the book, and you've written about it, and I've written about it. Home bias, the action of overweighting your home country and your investment portfolio relative to the markets, is prevalent not just in the United States, but essentially everywhere. Everyone does this. Canadians do this. Germans do it. The British do it. We do it. Why do we do this? This is a genuine question from me, because, and in my school, my circle of, kind of passive, low cost, buy and hold, quasi efficient market world, it may be the most prevalent.
I'll give you a very, very simple example. And for anyone listening to this call, I grew up in Denver mostly. So I'm a huge Denver Broncos fan, right? I mean, it is on Sundays, it is emotionally painful when they lose. I've been in depression since the Broncos playoff game,
where they were handily beaten by
it is very Colts. Real emotional, physical pain. But it's a very real, interest I have in the Broncos. Well, look, if I'd been born in Miami, it'd be totally different. And so people, one, it's what's comfortable. It's a sort of crowd groupthink, right? So here in America, we're surrounded by Americans. We think America is the best place on the planet. It's comfortable. It's what I can say, hey, I'm investing in Apple and Exxon and Walmart, and it's tangible, right? Well, it's the same thing for Italians or Brits or Australians or anyone in the world, and it happens everywhere. People overallocate to their own market relative to the global portfolio, and it's even more of a problem abroad, because the U.S. is half the world market cap. Right. So most investors invest around 70% of their equity allocation in the U.S. So it's not a huge major problem, 50% versus 70, as it would be in, say, Japan or Italy, where they're much, much smaller percentages of the world market cap, and you're putting most of your money in your home market. So it, however, is a problem now in the U.S. because the U.S. is one of the most expensive equity markets in the world. Now, it's not in a bubble. It's not terrible. You know, we look at long-term 10-year P.E. ratios called CAPE ratios, and the U.S. is around 27. You know, historically, it's been around 16, 17. In this sort of inflation regime, it can be up around 20. But so it's expensive, but it's been as high as 45 in the late 90s and as low as 5 before. So it's a pretty wide range of what people are willing to pay for stocks. Mm-hmm. So it's not above 30. That's really the bubble territory when there's really no reason to own stock. But the rest of the world is down around 15, and the cheapest stuff in the world is down around 8 or 9. So it particularly right now, to have the U.S. home country bias is, we think, not the brightest thing to be doing. And if you're living in a global world where everything's interconnected, it's even more reason to say, I don't care where I'm invested. I just want to be invested in what's cheapest.
Sure. The distinction may be largely false. You know, if we're talking about Nestle or Toyota or GM, their place of domicile is largely just that. Now, as an investor in the United States in international equities, you pick up currency risk unless you choose to hedge that. But as you've pointed out, that risk is largely neutral over time. That real currency returns are pretty close to zero.
Currencies are a fun topic because I feel like they're very poorly understood. They're confusing. And when we look at currency returns, like you mentioned, yes, over time, real currency returns adjust for inflation and they're fairly stable. Any given year, as you look and see what's happening with Swiss franc, with what's happened with the yen a couple years ago, what's happening with the ruble, any given year, they can move 30%, right? But over time, they're fairly stable. And it's with equities, I'm agnostic. You can either hedge them or you don't, but you need to stick with it, right? So you choose to hedge or not, and you stick with it, and it's not a big deal. With bonds, it's a little different because with foreign government sovereign bonds, you're introducing currency volatility into an asset class that's low volatility. So think U.S. Treasuries, right? So you don't really want the additional currency risk. So I think it makes a lot of sense to hedge foreign bonds. U.S. or foreign stocks, I'm agnostic. You can actually come up with some pretty good simple strategies. Value, momentum, carry is the most famous on currencies as an asset class. That's a totally separate topic. But in general, it's funny, you know, we're in a dollar bull, which is why this is such a popular topic.
Right,
you
know, cuz now everybody wants to start talking about hedging their currency risk.
Right. You know, it's a little too late in my opinion for a lot of that. So pick one side, stick with it. We don't hedge our foreign equity exposure, but have no problem with people to do.
Sure. I mean, a couple thoughts on that. One is on the fixed income side, what most of the data represent is if you hedge your international fixed income back to the dollar, you get something that looks a whole lot like a U.S. bond portfolio because of the cost of hedging and because we live in a global marketplace. And if you can get if money can get a higher yield somewhere, then it likely will. And so net of that hedging exposure, you may not pick up too much of a diversification benefit unless you're really worried about the United States. And, you know, this topic is so reflective of really all of this, which is it doesn't matter what you pick, but you have to stop changing your mind halfway through. You know, you can't decide after, you know, in 2009 to stop being a buy and hold investor. You can't decide in 2015 to start hedging your currency exposure. You can't decide after getting, you know, whipsawed a bit in a trend following strategy over the last 3 or 4 years to stop doing that and then start, you know, going back to being a buy and hold investor, which is what so many people do. I mean, it's why, you know, all the studies about investor returns show this huge gap between the actual market returns or asset class returns and what people earn in those markets. And in a sense, it's almost dangerous that there's so many investment options to people that you can choose to be a deep value guy, or you can choose to be a, you know, Boglehead indexer, or you can choose to be a momentum trader, because people have such a hard time living with the consequences of their decisions. One of my favorite things in your book is actually, unfortunately, not from you, but you quoted Cliff Asness, and he says, no strategy is so good that it can't have a bad year or two. And unfortunately, people don't want to believe that about the decision that they made.
Yeah, it's tough. You know, it's tough because it's painful. It's particularly when you're doing something different. If you're an active manager or doing something that's, and this is, you know, last year's a great example, U.S. stocks, U.S. bonds, REITs, lights out, right? So anyone that had returns that were less than those looked foolish, but that's the beauty of a sort of asset allocation portfolio, is that when U.S. stocks print a minus 10 or 20 year and foreign stocks or gold or commodities are up, you look, you know, brilliant, right? But it's nothing wrong with being wonderfully average in the asset allocation world, right? You get that average sort of middle of the road return, which is
really pretty good.
Nothing to complain about.
Right. It's just a matter of whether or not you're going to be willing to stick with your decision in an effort to do that. Because mm-hmm. if it's 2015, you're starting to question why you own international stocks or why you haven't hedged your currency exposure, then the system is broken. It's not, or you've broken the system in a sense. You know, the system works, but you have to work it, for to use a terrible phrase. I want to come back to one of the big takeaways of the book, maybe the big takeaway of the book, which is this idea that, okay, if we've analyzed and reviewed, are there 12 or so different asset allocation strategies in the book, and the delta between the best strategy and the worst strategy is, you know, something like 1.5%. And by the way, this was just eyeballing it, but it looked like if you cut off the worst strategy, which is the permanent portfolio, the 25% allocation to U.S. international cash and gold, is that right? Or bonds and gold?
Mm-hmm.
If you cut off the permanent portfolio, the cluster of the rest is actually really tight.
That's interesting. I should have looked at that. The thing is that if you were to tell someone, hey, look, go back to 1972 and you can pick out literally the best performing asset allocation. Now, you got to stick with it, but we give you the opportunity to pick out the best. And, you know, if you just added up, and they were even worse back then, right? The average mutual fund, 1.25% plus, you know, advisory fees, it transforms the best performing asset allocation into the worst. And that is a pretty good visual for people, right? Say, hey, look, you know, you have perfect foresight. You spend all this time, you get the perfect allocation, but oh, by the way, you focused on the wrong thing because you're paying so much in fees. You now have the worst performing asset allocation portfolio. That really hits home. But the reason people don't think much about fees is because they come out of, we call it, you know, they get skimmed off the top every day or every month or every quarter or year, depending on the fee schedule. And so you never really see them, never really think about them. But if you were to say, and this isn't a way that it works, of course, but if you say, hey, look, I got to take my mutual fund company, a briefcase of 20 grand every year, or once a quarter, I got to take them $5,000 and drop it off at their office. That's a totally different mindset than, hey, look, it's just going to come automatically out of the account, because it's not, you don't have the pain of it.
Right. Right? I mean, we've done a great job as an industry of sort of obfuscating the actual payment of fees.
Yeah, I agree with that.
It's metal worthy if there were such a horrible thing.
That's not for no reason.
Right. I mean, we could get into a whole thing about, you know, should the financial industry represent as big of a piece of the economy as it does, but we probably don't quite have the time for that. You know, I think any time we can have a conversation about what's really in our control and what's not, is a good thing. And it's tough for people to focus on that. And one, because the industry doesn't always want people to focus on that. We don't always want people to ask, you know, how an advisor gets paid, or, you know, what that represents. It's much easier to sit in a room with a guy who, you know, can speak eloquently about the risks in Greece today. But the reality is that what happens in Greece is not necessarily under our control, certainly not in the short term, and what happens, you know, in the next year if you have exposure to international stocks. But, you know, if you can get that average mutual fund fee of, you know, 1.25% down to 10 basis points for exposure to that same market, then that comes back to you.
Right. The good news is that we're living in a golden age of investing, meaning you could get access to markets and asset classes for such a low fee across the board. You know, that wasn't the case 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago.
Right.
And there's still some pockets and some areas that need to be disrupted a bit. And even the average fees are still very high. You know, the big mutual fund companies, it's something like 20 or 25% of the mutual funds charge a fee over 2%.
And yeah, staggering.
You know, those guys are never going to disrupt themselves. They're entrenched, so they're making that fat 2% fee. They're not going to give that up. But the good news is it's a one-way street. You know, an investor that was paying 2% that then is paying 5 basis points for, you know, 0.05% now for an index fund is never going back to the 2%er.
Right.
You know, they never go back and say, you know what, thank you for screwing me and paying a 5% load. And
yeah, that was really great. Can I have some more of that?
12% or a 0.5% 12b1 fee and a 2% management fee. You know, let's go back to that. That was a great idea. You know, and so that generation, which is, I think, the older generation, a lot of people that, and look, I don't necessarily blame the investors. Part of it's predatory on people that just don't know better.
Yeah, it's just information asymmetry.
But the more and more information out there, it's been look at the success of Vanguard and the indexing world in general. It's a very positive trend, and it's getting better and better as the years go on. So it's a plus, and you know, hopefully a lot of those funds will get disrupted and no longer have those structures, you know, when we talk again in 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, it seems inevitable that people collectively can only become more and more informed about what this world looks like. Now, there's a class of investors and a class of advisors who still sell the sizzle, you know, if you will, that, you know, tell people that once they've reached a certain level of wealth, they really do need exposure to complex layered investment products, which, you know, I'm pretty comfortable going on record saying is most likely not the case. But, you know, by and large, and, you know, I'm blinded by my own experience, as we all are, but, you know, people come to me saying, I think I'm starting to figure out that this old model, it wasn't really working for me. It wasn't doing anything for me. And it's difficult because it's all framed as, well, that's 1%. And, you know, my fee is 1%. But you live in a world where your fund is charging you 1%, your advisor's charging you 1%, and the fund is, you know, has a lot of turnover, then, you know, they have bid ask spreads and trading commissions, and that adds up. And then you're in a taxable account, and that adds up.
I saw a great example the other day is that, you know, one of the best marketing pieces for the asset managers is they say, you know, it's a percent of assets under management. But then if you said, let's reframe it. Let's look at that as a percent of performance. So even right. If hypothetically stocks did 10% a year, we'll actually do real returns. So they do 5% a year. All right, well, that's now down to 20% of your returns. And if you look at it as a percent of alpha, you know, if they're arguing that
they're about 200%.
So it's like 100% of the, you know, alpha if there was any. So it was a brilliant thing by marketers to say, no, we're going to market as a percent of assets under management. But as a chunk of performance, it's massive. You're giving up, you know, often 20%, 50%. Of your performance to the caretakers.
Yeah, I mean, if you expect real returns of 4% on a diversified portfolio, and you're paying 1 in mutual fund fees and 1 in advisory fees and 1 in taxes, it's gone. It's like right. You're taking all this risk. You know, nominal volatility, behavioral, all these risks that you're taking with your own money. It's pretty easy to part with a good chunk of your returns in current industry structures. And like you said, I do think the tides are turning. I think despite my concerns with their marketing strategies, if you will, I think the advent of the automated investment manager is a good thing. And ultimately this, our industry is finally starting to see competition and competition on price, and the consumer is the one to benefit from that ultimately.
Absolutely.
Well, we're about to run out of time. Meb, I want to thank you for being part of Fireside Markets today. Any last passing thoughts before I let you go?
No, I mean, if people want to find more information, you know, you can go to my blog. I think there's over 1,500 articles there, a handful of white papers. If you're still listening at this point, as a reward for still listening, email me and I'm more than happy to send you a free book of your choice if you made it this far. And otherwise, yeah, we'll have to do it again sometime soon.
All right, sounds great. Meb Faber, Chief Investment Officer at Cambria Investments. The book is Global Asset Allocation. Meb, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
For additional information, details regarding references made in today's episode, or to subscribe or comment on this podcast, visit us online at basinasset.com.